He pointed at a spot on the map even further south than Talis. From there they could have attacked either Talis or one of the border colonies, Verna thought. Clearly the king had wanted to keep his options open. Finally, he managed to speak. They will march on King's End next. His father looked up sharply, as if he'd forgotten his son was still there. Yes, they will. They left no fighting man alive, save for the few who managed to escape. They rounded up the women and children and elderly, and imprisoned them. King Strait was hoping to take us by surprise from the south, but we got lucky. Lucky? We lost our second largest city. In reality, calling Talis a city was being generous. Though a wall was being planned, the town was naught but a series of ramshackle houses built with very little order or planning. Thomas and Verna had been considering a visit to the town for a while, but hadn't yet gotten around to it. Yes, lucky. If we were unlucky, the Crimeans would attack without warning while we're staring at the sea, wondering where they are. Verna knew his father was right, but it still hurt to think of all those soldiers killed because they hadn't been better prepared. They couldn't let that happen again, not in Night's End. His mother's words came back to him. You have a mind for strategy. We need to rally the troops, begin setting up a perimeter, and focus our forces to the south.
Already done.
Then we should send scouts along the coast, and also on the western road, just in case they try to surprise us again.
The command was given an hour ago.
We must dig trenches, fill them with oil that can be lit with flaming arrows when the Crimeans arrive.
Naturally.
I had one of the captains appropriate 50 men to do just that, and the rest of the warships will sail from Bethany at first light. We will recall the scout ships, too. No sense in losing a single man before the real battle begins.
Verna was dumbfounded. But I thought you didn't want to fight.
I don't. And I won't. But that doesn't mean everyone else won't have to. The rest of the city isn't bound by a 50-year-old promise.
Verna felt foolish. Of course his father would protect the city. At this point, the Crimeans weren't interested in surrender. They wanted to reinforce their dominion over these lands, and surrender wouldn't be an option until blood was spilt in this very city. Then again, the defences would be fairly standard. The Crimeans would be expecting them. Would it be enough? Several mad ideas floated through Verna's mind, but who was he to second-guess his father's commands? The city had survived this long with him as its protector.
"What can I do?" he asked instead.
His father pushed away from the map, turning to face his son. His jaw was firm, his expression grim.
"For the first time in my life, I truly understand why my father, why Heinrich, commanded me to leave the expedition into the hinterlands. He probably saved my life when he did. And when he made me promise not to fight the crown, he was only trying to do what was best for me. But he was wrong. Not in his love for me, or his desire to protect his family, but in his belief that there weren't things worth fighting for, that independence didn't matter. I know what you believe in, son, and I won't try to stop you from fighting when the time comes. You will serve under Captain Lewis, if you choose.
Thank you, father, Verna said. I will protect the city. We will be victorious.
Is that all?
His mother's counsel came back to him. The voices in the council room. Choose to be one of them, or remain silent. Live with the consequences.
Yes, father.
Thomas turned back to his map as if he hadn't heard.
The Crimeans must have marched in 16-hour shifts in order to reach Night's End by nightfall 2 days later. In the shadows of the dying sunlight, Verna could just make out their green and black flags flapping in the wind, see the silver edges of their armour, glimpse the flashing edges of their swords and shields. He estimated their numbers at 10,000 strong. The sound of their feet marching across the hardened plains was like thunder, and Verna felt it tremble through him. Several hundred of them rode Mongol beasts. Standing on four legs as thick as tree trunks, they snorted and shook their heads, which were flat from back to front, ending in a long, curved spike on the tips of their snouts. Verna had seen them before.
Every so often the Crimean merchants would bring a few across the sea and offer rides for a fee. But he'd never seen so many at once, each framed with large sections of plate to protect the vital areas of their chests and throats. There would be no sleep on this night. Watching the multitude approach, he immediately recognized that the fire trenches they'd dug were too thin by half. The Mongol beasts would ride right over them, while the rest of the army would use long planks they carried on their shoulders, makeshift bridges, to span the gap. He bit his tongue, feeling the warm, coppery taste of blood in his mouth. "What can we do?" he thought, backing away from the edge of the wall. Panic seized him, and he had the sudden urge to flee to the inner portion of the castle, to find his father, to beg him to protect him. Why did he want to fight, anyway? What honor was there in dying? What honor was there in killing? "My son," a voice said from behind. He turned to find his mother, garbed in small white armor. Her short sword was sheathed in a leather scabbard.
Mother? What are you doing here? And why are you dressed like that? You must hide. The Crimeans are coming."
She smiled, though it was the saddest smile he'd ever seen. "They are already here," she said. "And I'm not bound by your father's promise either. I will fight and die if necessary. I will defend the loyal servants of the castle, from the scullery maids to the stable boys to the serving women. They deserve our protection, don't you think?"
Yes, of course, mother."
Werner felt like a coward. Here he was considering fleeing from the battle before it had even started, and his mother was charging into it.
"Did you speak to your father?"
"About what?"
"About what we talked about before. Strategy, defences, knights and dragons." "No, I mean, yes. He already had a plan in place."
His cheeks flushed when he remembered all he'd left unsaid.
"Is it a good one?"
"Not good enough."
"It's sensible. Standard defences for such an assault."
As if to illustrate, a shout burst through the darkening evening, carried from tower to tower by castle callers. Hundreds of flaming arrows soared through the air, a display so magnificent it took Werner's breath away for an instant. He ran to the parapets once more, watching as the arrows landed well short of the enemy, lighting the trenches in numerous places, the flames shooting up and racing along the pits until it was a single unbroken line of fire.
"Standard defences," his mother echoed, making him flinch.
He hadn't seen her approach to stand next to him.
"Yes," he said. "He'd given all the commands before I'd even spoken to him." "As long as you're satisfied."
He could tell by her tone she was disappointed in him, but she would never say as much to him. In that moment, as he watched the Crimean army approach the pits of flames, he felt useless, weak, more a boy than a man grown. And then, as they looked on, the Crimeans passed over the trenches as easily as fording a shallow river, on the backs of their beasts and bridges, as unstoppable as a giant black and green wave.
"Son," Viola said, gripping his arm, "there is no shame in hiding. Go, be with your father. He will appreciate the company."
Werner was halfway to his father's quarters when he stopped, clutching the wall, bent over his knees. He threw up the little he'd managed to eat for supper, his breaths coming in waves. He felt like a skeleton, his bones picked clean of muscle and flesh, devoid of blood or organs, his heart having shriveled up and fallen away, along with his brain. He'd failed the city twice now. First, when he refused to contradict his father's strategy, and second, when he'd run from the battle. The urge to curl up in a ball right here and now was so strong, it was like a set of powerful hands on his shoulders, forcing him down. Where was his sense of glory? Where was his honor?
"Was I born without a backbone?"
He sank to the floor, his head in his hands, his entire body racked with sobs. His eyes flashed open when strong arms lifted him up, crushing him in a clanking hug. His father's plate sang against his, even as his fierce eyes bore into him.
"Father,"
he said, tears still blurring his vision.
"What are you doing?"
"Breaking a 50-year-old promise,"
Thomas said. He wiped away his son's tears with a finger.
Are you certain?
As certain as anything in my life. My father wanted me to live, to be safe, but he was wrong to make me promise this thing. No man should be required to hide away while his people fight for their independence. Will you fight alongside me, son? All of Verna's fears and self-doubt rushed back.
I don't know if I can.
That's how you know your soul is alive, Thomas said. The fear is what makes you human. Now come, we have a victory to seize. Seeing the confidence and determination in his father's eyes gave him the strength he needed.
Thank you, father.
Thank you, son. You reminded me that some things in life are worth fighting for. The doors shook, sawdust and wooden splinters raining down on the helms of the soldiers standing in wait for their enemy to break through the gates. Rather than using a battering ram, the Crimeans simply charged several of the Mongol beasts into the thick wooden door again and again. Up above, on the castle ramparts, archers loosed wave after wave of arrows into the invading army, hoping to cull their numbers as much as possible before they breached the walls. Hot oil was dumped from large vats. Boulders were tumbled over the sides. The screams of soldiers dying assaulted Werner's ears like ill-tuned instruments. Not all were the enemy. The Crimeans loosed arrows of their own, killing dozens of archers, many of whom tumbled inside the castle walls, landing on the soldiers beneath them. Werner gritted his teeth, waiting beside his father. In some ways, the waiting was the worst part. He had the strong desire to urinate, but he held it back, focusing on the blade of his sword, which was tinted green with moonlight. He'd told his father about his mother's plan to fight, and Thomas had only shaken his head and offered a rueful look. She has her own mind, just as we do.
At least she's not at the front, Werner thought.
She would be the last line of defense, along with a group of castle guardsmen ordered to protect the inner sanctuary, where the servants had been gathered. All other non-fighting city dwellers had been told to stay inside.
Thud, thud.
To Werner's ears, it sounded like two Mongol beasts had hit the door at the same time. Something cracked, though the damage was invisible from the inside.
Thud, thud.
A seam rippled across the wood, and the jagged tip of a horn poked through. Several soldiers tried to hack at it, but mostly got in each other's way. One of the captains barked an order for them to back up, and the entire mass seemed to move as one, retreating enough so that they wouldn't be crushed when the doors came down.
Thud, thud, crack!
A thin gap appeared, widening as weapons and fists were shoved through, pulling, tearing, wrenching each half of the door to the side.
Attack!
The captain at the front shouted, and his force charged, stabbing through the breach. The cries of death resumed. One of the soldiers was pierced by a blade in his shoulder and stumbled back to be treated by the healers waiting well away from the fray. He brushed past Werner as he retreated, and he could see the pain on his face.
Pain is nothing next to oppression,
Werner thought. The idea seemed to steady his legs beneath him, and for a moment he managed to drag his mind away from the thick of the battle to a higher place, like looking down on a knights and dragons board. He frowned. If this were a game, they were about to engage in a strength-on-strength battle to the last soldier, last horse, last knight. Which would be fine if they had more pieces remaining on their side. But they didn't, which meant a different strategy was required.
"Drop back," he whispered,
the idea taking shape in his mind.
"What was that, son?"
his father asked, looking at him sharply. Werner didn't look at him, staring ahead at where the Crimean infantry had moved back, making room for the Mongol beasts to charge once more. Another direct hit and the doors would give way. There was no time to lose. He turned to his father, grabbing his shoulders with both hands.
"Give the command to drop back. Have each captain set up in a different part of the city. They can hide in alleys and buildings, taverns and marketplaces. Make them come to us. And then we'll make them pay for it."
He said the last sentence with a growl, certainty flowing through him.
This could work.
This would work. Thomas shook his head. "I won't give that order. I won't bring the wolf into our home." He shook his head again.
No. We stop them here at the gates, before they can destroy all we've built. With that, he strode forward with his sword raised, just as the doors burst inward with a final thud. War was even more brutal and chaotic than Werner could ever have imagined. He watched as a soldier was gored by a Mongol beast, the breath gasping from the man's lungs. The enormous creature thrust its head back and forth, trying to dislodge the corpse. Werner ducked, and the body flew past. A Crimean soldier bearing a red captain's seal on his helm leapt from the beast and charged him. Werner found his feet, slipped on the blood and ichor that filmed the stonework, and barely managed to raise his sword in time to block the slash of his enemy's weapon. The man, who wore a grey, well-trimmed beard, followed through with a shoulder to his chest, knocking him back. For a moment they struggled for an edge, while all around them the sounds of similar battles created a cacophony that seemed to dim with time. Werner remembered a trick he'd once used on the practice field when training with his father. It had worked then, and he'd impressed Thomas, a man who wasn't easily impressed. He dropped his shield. His foe's eyes widened in surprise, but Werner was already moving his free hand, gouging the man's eyes, and then sliding his hand down to secure his opponent's sword hand. The entire maneuver took less than a second, and before the man could react, Werner thrust with his sword, slipping past the now lowered blade of the captain. His aim was true, and the blade met little resistance as it sliced between plate and mail, sinking deep. The man's fingers lost all strength, and he dropped his sword. It was the first man Werner had ever killed. It would not be the last. Not on this night. Werner was proud of the soldiers of Night's End, but alas, it was not enough. They'd fought valiantly, many men losing their lives to defend their city, but still they'd been pushed back down the main thoroughfare, where the fighting became even more fierce in the larger area. Mongol beasts used the extra space to stampede, smashing anything in their path, whether man, horse, cart, or building. Shattered stones and cartwheels littered the streets, along with bodies. Too many bodies, both enemy and ally. Another round of retreats had recently been called, and for several precious moments, Werner was beside his father and the men who'd served under various captains, now fractured into one single group. The last stand. The Crimeans were regrouping, the surviving captains shouting out commands and formations. A healer tugged at Werner's arm, bandaging a slash across his hand that was bleeding profusely. Werner hadn't even known it was there. He was having trouble seeing out of one eye as well, the swelling fierce. He wasn't certain what had struck his face amongst the press of bodies and carnage, but there was little he could do for it now. One eye would have to suffice. "Son," his father said. "I'm proud of you. So proud." Sweat and blood beaded on his forehead, dripping from his brow. A ragged gash ran from temple to temple, a glancing blow that might have killed him had it landed squarely. "We've lost," Werner said. "It is no fault but mine. My strategy was flawed. I didn't give us a good enough chance. The trenches should have been wider, the attack more spread out."
"No, father. You did everything you could. You fought. That's what matters."
It wasn't entirely the truth, but the grim smile that formed on Thomas's face was worth the white lie. "You must flee. Find your mother and escape to the sea. Take a boat and sail somewhere safe. There is no dishonor in living." Though it was as great a temptation as Werner had ever faced, he shook his head.
"I shall not. I shall fight by your side. I shall die by your side."
There were tears in Thomas's eyes now, but he didn't argue, only nodded sadly.
"You're a better man than I."
"I have known no better than you, father."
They turned as one to face the enemy, who were rallying down the wide cobblestoned street, war cries on their lips. They were so close now that further retreat would be futile. Werner gritted his teeth, raised his shield and sword, and prepared to die a glorious death. A chorus of cries and shouts rang out from above, from both left and right, back and forward. Werner frowned, swiveling his head to locate the source. Heads appeared at windows and rooftops. Women, children, the elderly. They screamed at the Crimeans, uttering curses and taunts.
Soon stones flew through the air, some from slingshots and others from fists. Arrows and crossbolt darts, too. Hot water and flaming bottles followed next, and soon the enemy was forced to huddle beneath their shields under the onslaught. Thomas laughed a mirthless laugh, slapping Werner on the back.
Night's End will not go quietly into the night, it seems. They have given us a chance. Well, half a chance, but we'll take it just the same.
Men! Soldiers of the West! Attack! Attack! Attack!
With a roar, the soldiers launched themselves from where they were hunkered behind cart and barrel, charging for the enemy, who were just starting to creep toward the building doorways, as if they planned to search the houses for the women and children who assaulted them. Werner fell on the first soldier he came upon, smashing his shield into his side, knocking him sprawling. With renewed energy, he sprang upon him, stabbing him. The other soldiers were fighting with just as much passion as he, and soon the Crimeans began to scatter, falling out of formation as they fled. Townsfolk continued to harry them from above with anything they could throw or shoot, from stones to arrows to cookpots, the latter of which was surprisingly effective. Werner and his father ran with the other soldiers, though Thomas's aging legs soon fell behind. They didn't stop until the enemy was well and truly gone from the city, the damaged gates shut and barricaded. Archers flocked to the walls and fired upon the retreating Crimeans, disavowing them of any thoughts of regrouping for another attack on this night.
"A war of independence is not won with one battle," Thomas said, his eyes roaming up and down the men seated at the council table.
"But what a victory it was," one man said. "The bards will sing of it, till time itself lays down for the final sleep."
There were chuckles around the table, and even Thomas smiled. Werner knew the speaker well. He was an aging man, hoarm, grim, but had been one of Thomas's best friends for years. In fact, he was one of the original explorers from Heinrich's company when they discovered these very lands. Too old to be a soldier anymore, he claimed to have thrown an entire washbasin out the window during the battle, killing two Crimeans and knocking a Mongol beast senseless. Werner didn't doubt the old man's story. He was just glad he hadn't started throwing women and children out the windows, too. When the moment of lightness had run its course, Thomas said, "As our scout ships were returning to the bay, they spied 2 dozen warships approaching from the west. They flew green and black flags. The next attack will come from the sea." Werner's heart sank. Though he knew their fight for independence was far from over, he'd expected more time to prepare for the next attack. Perhaps they could try to make peace with the Phoenicians or Calypsians, request their aid. But now, warships were already headed their way.
"We're doomed," Werner thought.
"We are down to less than 1,000 soldiers. Each warship will likely contain 200 to 300 men. That outnumbers us by at least 5 times, if we're lucky."
"Bethany's ships are less than a day away," Alvin Korsgaard said.
He was one of the surviving captains, a stern man with a clean-shaven face and bright blue eyes that cut sharply from face to face as he spoke.
"That'll add at least 1,000 to our numbers. And we just received a pigeon from our southern colonies. Each of the 4 border towns are sending 500 able-bodied men."
Werner did the math quickly, his lips pulling into a smile. 3,000 more soldiers brought the total to almost 4,000. They were still outnumbered, but it sounded a far cry better than just a moment ago. Thomas rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
"Right now, we are a gnat on King Strait's backside. Given his lust for expansion, he's probably spread thin, fighting wars on 6 different fronts. Defeating him won't be enough. It will only turn more of his military attention toward us. Next time he'll send 200 warships."
Werner felt like his heart was on a string, being tugged up and down by each new piece of information. Was there hope, or wasn't there? Had his grandfather been right all along? Was bending the knee the only option besides death?
"What are you suggesting, Lord Protector?" Captain Korsgaard asked.
Thomas slammed his fist down on the table, making Werner jump.
"Our victory must be decisive. We must crush them like the spiders they are. King Strait needs to believe it will be more profitable to give us our independence on our terms, so that the trade route might be reopened."
"How do we do that?"
Werner blurted out.
When every head turned in his direction, he said, "I mean, I was on the streets during the last battle. At best, we traded the Crimeans man for man from start to finish. Another result like that, and we will have no one left to fight."
"My point, exactly," Thomas said, nodding in Werner's direction. "I was too hasty to underestimate our enemy the last time. We cannot afford another mistake. I want ideas, anything and everything. Nothing will be laughed at, no matter how outlandish."
There was a moment of silence as the men around the table considered the situation. Werner noticed his mother slip through the rear entrance, sliding into a chair nearby. Her eyes met his, and she nodded, a thin smile rising to her lips. Werner's mouth went dry. Did she really expect him to speak up during a council meeting full of men twice his age? Men who had fought in numerous battles against the natives to the south? Some of these men had even seen Crimea, whereas he'd seen nothing beyond the walls of Night's End.
"Catapults and great harpoons," one man said.
Jordan Goldburn, the captain of the guard. He was a barrel-chested mongrel with a face only a mother could love. His curly hair was beginning to thin at the front, and he was constantly compensating by flopping the rest of his hair over the spot.
"Rip holes in a few of their bows from a distance, and they'll think twice about docking in the bay."
Harper Forager, the keeper of the coin, said,
"It's possible, but construction would need to begin immediately, and would require most of the castle's purse. Since the interruption in trade, profits have been on the decline."
Werner wanted to shout,
"They'll just make landfall somewhere else,"
but the words stuck in his throat. As it turned out, others had the same thought, and the idea was soon shot down. Other ideas began popping up from other members of the council, everything from meeting them ship for ship in the bay to allowing them to dock before lighting their ships on fire and using the sea as a barricade to retreat. Every idea had numerous negatives, and soon the discussion had become a heated argument. Thomas's head was in his hands as he watched Grimm shout at Forager, while Corscott called Goldburn a
"bloody fool of the highest order."
Werner glanced at where his mother had been sitting, but she was gone. He had several ideas, but at this point was afraid to say anything for fear of the council's wrath. Finally, Thomas grunted.
"Enough,"
he said, pounding the table once more.
"Arguing is wasting what little time we have. Break for a meal, and we'll reconvene in an hour. Each of you bring your top idea, and then we'll take a vote. The idea with the highest votes will be carried out immediately."
Grumbling, the men pushed back their chairs and left, until it was only Thomas and Werner left.
"Father," Werner said.
"Hmm?" His father looked surprised anyone was still there.
"Oh, yes. Do you favor any of the ideas put forth thus far?"
I think you're right.
They're all ridiculous. At best we'll earn a slim victory, but it will cost us dearly. Maybe I am too old for this. Perhaps I should step down and let the people choose their own leader. After all, it was the king who chose me."
"No,"
Werner said. His father looked amused at the vehemence of his response.
"During the battle you didn't think I was fit to lead, or have you forgotten so quickly?"
"No, I mean, yes, I mean, I don't think you're unfit, father. Just that you and all these other men are
stubborn. Old turtles with our heads in our shells."
"I was going to say uncreative."
That drew a wry smile.
"I didn't hear any ideas from you."
Werner blew out a breath.
"I know. I was afraid I would be shunned."
"Just like you were afraid to fight before the battle."
"Yes, exactly. I have no experience. Who am I to advise the council on military action?"
Thomas stood, rounding the table.
"That's not the point I was trying to make. You did fight. That's what I was saying."
Werner shook his head.
"As soon as Mother gave me the option to hide behind the castle walls, I took it. I was a coward."
He looked up at his father, expecting to see shame in the man's eyes. He was surprised to see an amused gleam instead.
"You don't know your mother as well as I do. She didn't give you the option to make you look like a coward.
She just knows something that most men don't. Bravery isn't fighting when you have no choice. Bravery is when you have a choice and choose to fight anyway. She gave you that option, and you made the courageous choice.
Only because you encouraged me.
Just as you encouraged me. Our deeds are no less honorable, because we needed some help along the way. Now, forget about all those old squabbling men. How do you advise me?
Once more, he noticed his mother. This time she was partly hidden in a shadow near the rear entrance, just listening to their conversation. He remembered what she'd told him before the last battle. You beat your father in 5 moves.
Yes, he thought. I have a mind for strategy, and not just in some stupid game.
He opened his mouth and told his father his ideas. When he'd finished, Thomas just stared at him, his expression unreadable.
I've gone too far,
Werner thought.
I've put the ridicule in ridiculous, the out in outlandish, the fool in...
His father's face changed in an instant, his eyes lighting up.
My boy, I think you're brilliant, he said. I shall put it to a vote at once.
The vote was unanimous. Werner's strategy would be enacted with urgency. Knight's End's independence was the prize. The meeting ended with much backslapping and an air of excitement. Werner felt more confident than he'd ever felt in his life. To think, the fate of their new nation would be relying on ghost ships and wine barrels. Shrouded in darkness, stuffed between the hard wooden slats of an empty wine barrel, Werner felt anything but confident.
I'm a foolish fool, he thought. No, worse than that. A foolhardy, foolish fool, with a fool head full of foolish ideas. What was I thinking?
Similar doubts had been creeping in over the last 2 days, as preparations had been made to carry out his plan. Now, as his scheme was about to be hatched, they'd come to a head. The fate of a new nation was at stake, and he was hiding in a wine barrel. He swallowed the fumes of fermented grapes, trying to breathe, trying not to panic.
This will work, he whispered to himself. This might work. This won't work. Shut up, head!
He wanted to shout, but clamped his lips shut. Part of the plan relied on absolute silence. A sound caught the edge of his hearing. A creak, perhaps the tightening of a wooden board, or the winching of a rope pulled tight. There were no shouts or war cries, no whisper-like zips of arrows being fired into the city, no stomping feet. No, the first Crimean ship to arrive came on padded feet and muffled lips. Perhaps the Crimeans believed the first battle had taken all the fight out of Knight's End, and that the city would resist no longer.
Let them think us defeated, Werner thought.
The faintest glimmer of hope blinking through the miasma of fear and self-doubt that had taken up residence in his mind. Louder sounds arose now, splashes of anchors, and the grunts of men tying off ropes. The metallic sound of armor, shield, and sword, and the thud of boots on the wooden docks.
What in the high seas?
Someone muttered. Werner held his breath. Part one of his plan was about to begin, and if it failed, it was likely the rest would fall apart like a poorly constructed chair sat upon by a man of great girth.
Wine barrels and white flags of surrender, another man said, chuckling. We bring soldiers, and they face us with an army of the finest wine in the Western world.
The white flags had been his father's idea. Thomas had latched onto the plan with both hands, helping to add details to make the ruse more believable. There were more chuckles, alongside the sound of swords being sheathed.
"Remain on your guard," a gruff voice said. "This doesn't smell right."
"Smells of strawberries and plums to me, Captain,"
someone responded, snorting at his own joke. The vineyards surrounding Knight's End were famous for the fruity flavors of the wine they produced.
"More like a trap," the captain said, his boots clopping closer. "Give me something to pry one open with."
Werner's held breath tightened his chest further, and his heart began to race.
It's over. They'll find us, and we'll be killed before we can even draw our weapon.
There was a creak and muffled sound, and then...
"Wine,"
the captain said. A series of creaks and clatters followed.
"Just wine,"
he said once more. Werner slowly released his breath, his heart slowing, though not completely.
"Well, I say we break out some flagons and celebrate our victory. In the name of the king,"
the jokester soldier said.
"It's probably poisoned,"
the captain said.
"We'll take some prisoners and have them test each barrel before we partake."
"That's why you're the captain,"
more chuckles. Conversations began in earnest, the hushed silence broken as the Crimeans started to truly believe they'd won without bloodshed.
"What now?"
"First, we search the ships. They may appear to be derelict, but thoroughness will be rewarded."
There were grumbles and groans, but feet thudded along, past where Thomas and the other 500 soldiers were hidden. He prayed they wouldn't check any more wine barrels. They'd only filled the first three rows with real wine.
"You three," the captain said. "Signal the other ships to make landfall, and then remain behind to notify the captains of the situation upon arrival. Have them wait for our return before marching on the city."
A chorus of, "Yes, captains," answered. Werner was surprised to learn only one ship had laid anchor thus far. For some reason, he'd expected them all to arrive at once. Perhaps when their spyglasses showed an empty dock and white flags, the Crimeans had decided to send one ship ahead to scout. The footsteps faded away. Werner suspected the search of the derelict ships wouldn't be as thorough as the captain desired, though it wouldn't matter anyways. They wouldn't find anything more than some broken bottles and other scattered debris across the decks. Below decks they'd find unmade beds and dirty clothes. They would believe the ships were riding low in the water because they were no longer seaworthy, full of holes and other damage beneath the surface of the bay. Not because there were thousands of enemy soldiers hiding in each ship's belly beneath the lowest decks, ready to spring from hidden trapdoors the moment the signal was given.
"Ghost ships and wine barrels,"
Werner thought, smiling grimly. Whether it ended in victory or defeat, the bards would sing of this night for centuries to come. Meanwhile, a muted argument had broken out.
"Captain won't even know we've drunk any,"
one man said.
"He will, because I'll tell him.
You're a damned traitor.
And you're a damned lush."
"Shut it, both of you. We'll each have a sip, that's all."
Feet scuffled closer to where Werner was hiding.
"Oh, shite. What are you doing? These ones are already open."
"And I prefer the strawberry kind. See the markings? This is the good stuff."
"Double shite."
Werner cursed his stupidity and lack of foresight. He should have put a variety of barrels of real wine at the front. Instead, he'd just randomly chosen. He tried to remember what markings were on his barrel. They might have been strawberries, but he couldn't be certain. Not that it mattered. If any of the barrels containing men were opened, the ruse would be up. His lid rattled above him. The lids of the barrels containing soldiers weren't even secured, else they wouldn't be able to escape their hiding places with speed.
"This one's already open," the man said. "Hope it's still fresh." "You fool. The best wine is aged."
"I'm not a fool."
Werner stared at the lid, which had tilted, one end opening to the night-dark sky, where a sliver of moonlight spilled through. His sword was already out, pointed upwards, and as soon as he saw the pale contours of the face peeking inside, he shoved the blade with all his might. The soldier never had a chance. He didn't even make a sound, other than the thump of his body as it hit the dock.
"What the—"
The confused cry of one of the other soldiers was cut off, and as Werner rose from his crouch, pushing the lid aside but catching it before it could fall, he saw two more bodies slump to the wooden deck. A dozen of the hidden soldiers had emerged at the same time, and two of them had been close enough to the enemy to kill them before they could raise an alarm. Their eyes met Werner's, and they seemed to ask, "What now?" like Werner was the leader. In truth, he was, at least as far as the plan went. Once the true fighting started, the regular captains would resume command.
"We need to get rid of the bodies," he whispered, "and hide the blood. The captain will notice his three men are missing,"
another man hissed back. Captain Corscott. The serious man had challenged Werner's scheme a dozen times already.
"But he won't know what happened to them. It's the only chance."
Grudgingly, Corscott nodded, and grabbed five other men, two per corpse, to dispose of the bodies and move their barrels to cover the pools of blood. Verna gestured to any of the men who'd emerged from their barrels to get back down and pull their lids after them. Then he watched as the corpses were carried onto the very ship they'd come from and dumped unceremoniously over the wooden railing.
"You don't think they'll go back on the ship?" Verna asked.
"No reason to," Korsgaard said. "Unless they're trying to retreat, in which case our plan worked."
Verna was glad to hear him say "our plan" this time. For the last 2 days, the experienced captain had been calling it Verna's plan, despite having voted for it at the council meeting. Verna nodded and said,
"Back in the barrels. Let's hope it does work."
Once more, darkness surrounded Verna, his cramped muscles screaming.
"Just a little longer," he thought.
More sounds approached, similar to before but in greater number. The other 23 ships made quite a ruckus, especially because many of them wouldn't find space along the docks. They would have to anchor further out, and then come ashore via smaller boats. Soon, however, it was clear there were hundreds, if not thousands, of the enemy all around them. Boots stomped, captains shouted orders. Several men wondered aloud why no one from the previous ship had stayed back to tell them what was going on. There were plenty of comments about the open wine barrels, but any notions of partaking were quickly shut down by those in authority. That caused plenty of grumbles and curses. Verna's back was on fire. He didn't know how much longer his body would accept being in this position.
"Just a little longer,"
he thought again, wondering if it would become his mantra. Eventually, when the pins and needles in his legs had given way to numbness, a familiar voice cut through the din.
"Nice of you to come ashore,"
the first captain, the suspicious one, said.
"Nice of you to leave a welcoming party for us, to tell us what the hell is going on,"
someone else answered.
"I did. 3 men.
"Well, if they're here, they did a shite job. They haven't told anyone anything." The captain cursed.
"After this is over, I'll find a suitable punishment. But now, we have work to do. We searched the ships, all abandoned. It appears the surrender is real. We should march on the gates and demand that the Lord Protector, Thomas Garrick, be handed over. Without their leader, we shall have nothing to fear from Night's End."
There was general agreement, and then the sound of marching troops, a sound that seemed to last for an eternity, thousands of boots moving together, accompanied by the clinking of armour. As the final footfalls began to fade away, Verna's heart started beating faster once again. Once there was complete silence, save for the occasional creaking timber or lapping wave, he counted to 100, slowly, just to be certain. Then he pushed out from his barrel, a cool breeze wafting across his sweat-lined skin. First he looked up the incline that led to the city. The last of the enemy soldiers were just now rounding the edge of the city walls, making for the main gate. Shadows against stone, they might have been weary travellers seeking sanctuary. Satisfied that they were safe, he offered the agreed-upon bird call, and soon lids were sliding away from barrels and men were climbing out, flexing their knees and elbows, trying to get feeling back to their extremities. Verna did the same, and then walked along the docks, using the same bird call as he passed each of their own ships. More soldiers began to emerge, climbing across gangways and spilling onto the dock, offering grim smiles and salutes as they passed him. When he reached the end, he turned and joined the throng, allowing himself one gaze across the bay, which was full of sleek, silent enemy ships, their shadows invading the twinkle of starlight across the water. When he reached the shore, the captains were already barking out orders, setting up archers, each of whom fitted their bowstrings with arrows, which were then painted with oil and set alight. They flew through the air, but would be seen by none but those atop the castle ramparts. The walls of Night's End would hide the rest from their enemy. One by one, the enemy warships caught fire, and were soon floating infernos, the smoke pouring from prow and sail, mast and deck. Nothing would be able to hide the smoke from the Crimeans, which meant it was time to move. After all the waiting, Verna felt as if they were moving at double speed as they trotted up the incline, 2,000 strong. The other 2,000 soldiers were safely inside the castle walls, awaiting a signal from the spotters in the towers that it was time to unleash the final part of the scheme. The ground beneath their feet was riddled with heavy boot prints as they made their way along the wall. Ahead, shouts burst forth. The Crimeans had seen the smoke. Bells began to toll from the towers, ringing forth for all to hear. Though they hadn't rounded the southeastern edge of the rectangular wall yet, Werner could just make out the heavy groan of hinges as the main gates were opened. He wondered if ever before in the history of warfare a battle had started with one side opening the gate to invite the enemy in.
There's a first time for everything, he thought.
A familiar sound blotted out all other sounds. The chaos of war. The men in front and back of him released a cry of, "Freedom!" which Werner gladly echoed, and began running, spilling around the corner of the wall, weapons raised. The battle was already raging, with the Crimeans funneling through the city entrance, already making decent headway. However, those in the back and on the sides swiftly realized they were being flanked. Confusion set in. The captains focused forward, while their men were forced to decide what to do. Some pushed forward harder, shoving their allies ahead, while others turned to fight. Still others tried to flee, but the same fire trenches that had been so useless before now prevented their retreat. With a final cry of, "Freedom!" Werner and his comrades met the enemy. The fighting was fierce, with most of the enemy choosing to push into the city rather than try to flee. Though Werner's plan had worked to perfection, the Crimeans were natural soldiers and, surrounded, fought like cornered wildcats. As Werner fought, the difference between life and death, once a wide gulf in his mind, felt as narrow as the width of a single strand of hair. He killed because the only alternative was to be killed. Every stride required the dodging of corpses underfoot, and his feet slid and slipped on the blood running down the streets. By the time the last Crimeans were cut down, he'd taken several injuries and was light-headed from loss of blood. His sword hung aimlessly in the air, searching for enemies where there were none left. His comrades stood all around him, their eyes as wild and vacant as he suspected his were. They were covered in life and death, painted with souls. They were freedom. They were vengeance. They were killers, every one. They were heroes, every one. And then his father and mother were there by his side, embracing him, embracing each other, and the tears flowed. The tears flowed. Like rain. 2,000 of their own had perished. 2,000 souls seeking independence. 2,000 heroes fighting for a cause greater than the sum of their lives. Werner thought about those men and women, and wondered whether, before they took their last breaths, they knew of their own greatness. He hoped they did. 5,000 Crimeans had died. The few whose injuries did not kill them had been treated and were being held prisoner. They all told the same story, that King Strait was on his deathbed. He would not last a fortnight, according to rumors. A long flying pigeon would be sent across the great waters with a message for King Strait and his heirs. "We are free. You may come for us, but you will not survive. For we do not fight for land or wealth or power. We fight for our very lives. And we shall not fail." Standing atop the wall, Werner and his family looked down upon the streets of Night's End. They were stained red, but it was not blood he saw, but
roses, he spoke aloud. "A layer of rose petals."
"Yes," his father murmured. "I see it too."
"And I,"
his mother agreed. And that was how the First Independence War got its name. The War of Roses. King Strait was dead, but the Crimeans would never forget their defeat. They would come again. But Werner wasn't worried about that now, only about the chance they now had. A chance to build a better world. A chance to forge alliances with their neighbors. A chance for peace. He hoped they wouldn't waste it.
Postlude 3. Sonic Evade. The Southern Kingdom, circa 524. Civil War. The dissolution of the marriage alliance between Calypso and Fanes had been the most popular topic of rumor and gossip in Fenia for months.
Fighting was fiercest along the spear, with both sides taking major casualties.
Good,
Sonica thought.
Let the Phoenician soldiers die.
She was vaguely aware that she was scowling, but didn't care. The leather-clad soldiers who were passing were oblivious to her animosity, too busy showing off for the crowds gathered to cheer them as they marched to war. They flipped and vaulted and sprung, a masterful display of the martial art of Fenru. Though they were weaponless now, when they ran into battle their feet and wrists would be strapped with deadly blades.
Fenru is an arrogant, bloodthirsty art,
Sonica thought.
I could defeat any of them with half as many maneuvers.
She wasn't certain if it was true or not. Though she'd mastered the womanly dance of Fen Sir 3 years earlier, it was considered a dance rather than a martial art. But she felt better thinking it, just the same.
You're going to burn a hole through them with that stare of yours,
her brother said, standing motionless beside her. Gat Vaid was more than just her older brother. He was her best friend, and, at times, voice of reason.
Let them burn,
Sonica muttered, just loud enough for him to hear. All around them, chalk-faced people cheered, applauding and whistling for each aerial trick.
Come on, we should get home.
She knew he was right. The more she watched the soldiers, the more likely she was to do something foolish. She wondered why she'd wanted to come to watch in the first place. Gat's tall, powerful body threaded through the throng, leaving a path for Sonica to follow in his wake. She ignored the stares that met her from all sides. She was used to it. There were very few Phoenicians who didn't powder their faces these days, and even fewer who, like she and her brother, were unadorned with gem and jewelry, fine silk and golden threads. Wearing basic clothing, not unlike that of the slaves, they stuck out like a couple of black eyes. When Sonica was certain she was going to hurt someone, they finally emerged from the press of bodies and into open space. The canyon walls stretched toward the sky on both sides, and Sonica longed to climb them, to rise above the world that felt more and more like a prison with each passing day.
Later,
she thought, promising herself. Lost in her own thoughts, she barely noticed the shops carved into the stone walls on each side. Fine silks woven with gemstones. Gaudy, brimless hats that seemed to serve no purpose other than to draw attention. A parlour where gems could be sewn right into your skin permanently. Even the food sellers were of little interest to Sonica in her current mood. She'd lost her appetite the moment she saw the soldiers, but Gat forced her to buy a serving of stuffed pison with rice. It was delicious, smoky and sweet at the same time, but she had to force it down. She saved half of it. Gat didn't touch his own portion, keeping it wrapped up the entire journey home. Home was a wide, deep gouge in the stone. To get there, they had to pass hundreds of other man-made caves, pockets carved into the canyon walls that made it resemble a honeycomb. At first, they were lavish homes, complete with natural, flowing water, fine furniture, and marble steps curving back and forth from bottom to top and back down again. The wealthiest lived at the top, and even had pulley systems in place to save their legs from the climb. The further along they went, the less populated the canyon became, until most of the caves were empty. Further still, they arrived at their own cave, the most basic of them all, set at the very bottom of the wall. There were no other caves above them, no stairs or pulley systems. Just a rock wall with plenty of interesting hand and footholds. To get water, they had to walk to a well and haul it back. To reach the markets, they had to walk nearly as far as the slaves.
The slaves, Sonica thought.
The slaves were the reason none of the Phoenicians lived this far south in the canyons. Because, just a stone's throw away, were the slave quarters. Thousands of tiny cubicles chiseled into the canyon walls, reachable by a rickety, chipped steps that were more dangerous than they were functional. Occasionally someone would fall to their death, not that anyone cared. Slaves were easily replaceable. More than anything else, the thing that frustrated Sonica was that the slaves were so close to the end of the canyons, so close to freedom. But none of them would try to escape, for they were enslaved not by chains, but by magic. Emperor Hoza was slave-marked, able to capture the minds of anyone he chose. Thus, the slaves' eyes were all the same color, black, regardless of what color they were before. They walked stiffly, going wherever their masters instructed them, doing whatever they were told. Sonika realized she had stopped, staring ahead, her face once more plastered with a scowl.
"Coming?" Gat said, waiting for her.
"Where?"
"To make a delivery."
She nodded. First, they found a sharp stone and cut what was left of their meal, half of hers, all of Gat's, into smaller portions. Then they went from cubicle to cubicle, giving a bite to each of the children who were too young to work, waiting for their parents to return from their labors. Most of the children just stared at them as they chewed. They were almost entirely Terrans, from the nation of Terragon, a land located across the burning sea. Their skin was red, which was why the Phoenicians started powdering their own skin, to look as different from the slaves as possible. Their eyes were wide and round, unlike the narrow, scythe-like eyes of the Phoenicians. They didn't make it very far before they ran out of food. The children in the next cubicle stared at them, but didn't beg. They were used to being hungry, and their parents would return soon with their meager rations for the day. Still, it broke Sonika's heart in two. Finally, they entered their own abode, which was warm and cozy. Sonika's mother, Bryda Vade, was preparing the evening meal, beans and rice spiced with cumin. She cooked the food in an enormous iron pot that could feed 10 times as many people. She turned as her children, who were both old enough to leave home if they wished, entered.
"You stopped by the slave quarters," she said.
"And watched the latest group of soldiers leaving the city," Gat said. Bryda shook her head.
"Not our business. The wars of emperors and empresses are of little use to working folk."
Sonika didn't want to start another fight as soon as she'd arrived, but biting her tongue was something she struggled with.
"How can you say that? If the Calypsians defeat us, everything will change. Empress Sun Sands is against slavery."
It only frustrated her more that her mother didn't react to her raised voice, her own demeanor as even as the ground beneath their feet.
"We all do our part in our own way. We help where we can. But we are not soldiers, none of us."
"They try to recruit me again today," Gat said. Finally, Bryda frowned.
"I wish they would leave you alone."
"They won't," Sonika said. "Have you seen him? He puts half the army to shame."
"Only half?"
Gat said, with a raised eyebrow.
"Give or take."
Her mother changed the subject, something she was quite adept at doing.
"How was the dance today?"
The dance was what she called Sonika's work. Since becoming a master of Fen Sir, the dance of the sun goddess, Sonika had made a living teaching girls half her age. Gat worked with her, sort of. He helped recruit new students. Given the way he looked, he brought in a lot of business, even if most of her students were there just to stare at Gat and had no natural talent for the dance. Still, Sonika enjoyed her work, and the extra coin it brought in, most of which they used to help feed the slaves. She also liked working with her brother, though he teased her mercilessly.
"The dance was fine," Sonika said. "Fine, fine, fine. What more could you want from life?"
And there it was, the problem that had no solution. Their life was fine. She wanted for nothing. She enjoyed her work, she tried to help others. But it wasn't enough for her. There had to be more.
"Nothing, mother," she said, sighing.
"Not even a hug from your father,"
Lor Vade said, entering the cave. Sonika turned, feeling a flush of relief at her father's presence. For some reason, she only fought with her mother, while her father could always calm her restless energy. His narrow eyes held the twinkle of starlight, and his tanned, weathered skin proved a life of hard work as a stonemason. Though there were slaves available to do his work, none were as well trained as he. Still, work had been on the decline for the last few years, as slavery became more prevalent. Why pay for work when it could be done for free?
"Of course, father," she said, allowing herself to be pulled into a firm embrace. "He gets a hug, and I get frustration," her mother noted.
"I've got a hug for you," Gat said.
Sonika felt bad as she released her father. She waited her turn and then hugged her mother.
"Sometimes I think we're too much alike," her mother said.
Sonika frowned, pulling back to look at her mother, but she was already twisting away, going back to stir the beans.
"Alike? More like as different as the moons from the sun, as different as fire and water.
Behind her, Lor laughed, embracing Gat, who was a head taller than him. They slapped each other's backs. "How goes the stone breaking?" Gat asked.